I'm Brian McCreath from WCRB. I'm at the New England Conservatory with Kim Kashkashian. Kim, you've taught here for many years, and thanks for taking a little bit of time out of your pretty busy teaching schedule to talk with me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, and it's not such a busy day. Our audition season has just come to a close, so things are looking more calm.
I got you at a good time then. That's great. So let's talk a little about Music for Food. I think, am I correct that it's about 10 years now that you've been doing this project? And am I correct that you are basically the person who came up with this idea?
Brian, next year will be our 10th anniversary, 10th season. So we're looking forward to a very special kind of celebrating. About the idea, I would have to say that my dear friend and colleague, Carol Rodland, started a program called If Music Be the Food, which of course is the Shakespeare quotation, in Rochester when she was teaching at Eastman. And I took the idea directly from her and in fact said to her, hey, how about I do that in Boston? And by some quirk of fate, one of her ex-students who was here sat down and we made our first website. And we made it with a slightly different name, which is why there are now two organizations serving pantries through music.
But this series for sure has had a lot of success, not just in the raw support of food pantries, but success in drawing people into the issue, both musicians and audience. How hard or easy, maybe I should say, was it to ask your colleagues to participate in this project when you first got started? And do you even have trouble finding enough space for everybody who wants to participate now?
Brian, it's amazing to have seen, and it was a learning experience for me, to have seen how powerfully the musicians are affected by being able to play with this double purpose of making beautiful music and also creating food for those that need. And everyone who plays always comes to the backstage area afterwards and says, wow, that felt different. And so we learned that, in fact, it feels different to the audience because they're making an active investment, not just receiving the music, but giving back, literally. And we've found that it makes a huge difference to the musicians, and it gives the young musicians who are starting their professional lives a kind of positive hope and positive frame of reference for themselves, not only in the world of music, but in the world that they live in today.
This is really interesting to me. I want to ask you a little more about it because, you know, when especially in relation to those you teach, young musicians come to, especially to a place like the conservatory, very focused. And in my experience, I only say this in the best way, that they are focused on themselves, on their progress in their chosen instrument or field. And what you're describing is a way that taps into what is also underneath a lot of that a lot of the time, which is the desire to serve, the desire to give something. And this, what I hear you saying, kind of unlocks that in a new way that some people don't really realize until they actually do it.
Well, music in its essence is an act of healing. And all of us in that sense are wired to serve. All musicians, even the ones that seem only interested in their virtuoso careers, it's still a kind of service. And to have Music for Food as a house, as a model, that can be used by any musician anywhere, anytime, it just allows, it's a vehicle for the musicians to be able to express another side of that service drive that we all have.
So with this concert, you and Robert Levin revisited some material that you had recorded some years ago, and that is a beautiful recording on ECM, the label that you've worked with for a long time, and these South American songs. And I actually even talked with Bob a little bit at the concert afterwards, and he described the intensity with which you approached these. This wasn't a matter of taking printed songs for vocalist and piano and simply reading them together. Tell me about taking these songs that were written for that context, but making them your own with Robert in a way that makes sense for your particular textures and instruments.
Very interesting question. We both, I think, Robert and I both have a vocal frame of reference for what we do with our instruments. So the idea of singing with our instruments, with or without words, is a primary, no matter what. And then to take the focus of an actual art song, and in some cases folk songs, and say, okay, how much of this survives without the text? And there were certain songs that we loved but decided not to use, because without the text, it seemed that we weren't necessarily coming out at an even balance of plus and minus. Whereas with the ones that we did choose, and we went through mountains of songs, literally mountains. Both of us still have our song corner in our music rooms. Some songs actually could be said, you could say that it gains from the change of texture and actually the lack of text, which provides a kind of ambiguity which can be very powerful.
Yeah, and so with this particular set of songs, the mountain of songs you're describing, it's interesting to me that you went at this with songs that we don't think of, I want to put this really, really right, that don't think of it as sort of the classical canon, the leader, just to give it the shorthand, from Europe. What is it that's different about these songs, perhaps, that makes them more available to the kind of treatment that you and Bob did with them, rather than, say, Schubert Lieder or Wolf Lieder or anything like that?
Well, we have experimented with sets of French songs and American songs, including Copland, and all of those work very well, but the South American might be our favorite region. Because I run hot-blooded, and I like the context of pain, suffering, and joy that is probably apparent in any of these songs. So that's it's a place where I feel very much at home. So, and I would say that in my case anyway, that growing up hearing the Armenian songs and folk music had a lot to do with my love of song.
You also travel the world as a soloist and collaborator with other artists, musicians. Have you been in South America and encountered some of these songs or some of their songs' relatives maybe, and even gained further insight into them?
Well, now that's an interesting question too, because a lot of what we chose and the composers that we were picking from were actually choices that Robert made when he was in South America. He, of course, being who he is, spent any of his spare time in old music stores and looking at records and scores and things, and he found our sources.
Okay. And just, working with Robert Levin must be a real trip. I mean, this guy is so brilliant, and there's so much going on with him that it must be at times, probably always thrilling, but maybe at times even overwhelming to work with someone like that.
I'm going to give you a little context here. We first started playing together in 1972, and we belonged to a group called the Philharmonica in New York, chamber music, mixed chamber music group. And I knew then that I loved playing with him, but I had no idea how brilliant he was. And I have to say that every year that I've known him, my awe, respect and awe for that brain and heart, I must say, it's balanced in his case, has grown to the point where now I feel like, I don't know why he bothers to play with me. I don't know anything. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right. But he's never overwhelming with his knowledge. It's just always out of pure joy of music making.
Might I ask you about your recording of Bach's suites? This is material that we hear on the cello typically these days, although it's not uncommon to hear them in other contexts. And there's a few things that I'm curious about. One is simply, how long have you lived with this material? I mean the viola is an octave up from a cello, so I imagine in some form of even just practicing them for fun or education on your own, you've lived with them for a very long time. Am I right about that?
Well, I hate to tell you how long, but...
I'll
give you a number, but I will say that all violists consider this music to be part of the repertoire, and we start to learn it quite early. So I've been playing it, let's say, since I was 12 years old.
Wow. Okay, so with that in mind, what made this last year the time to actually get into a studio and work with ECM to put together a recording, your own take on these, at least as it is right now? What was it that made this the right time to get to them?
I will, as I always do, want to credit Manfred Eicher with the initial impulse. Many people have asked me over the years, why haven't you recorded Bach? You play it in a unique way. Why haven't you recorded? And I've always said, not sure. Not maybe when the right time comes. And he heard me play a solo concert of Kurtagen Bach. It's been 4 years now, in a church in Austria. And afterwards, he said, you've got to record Bach. And I rarely do what other people tell me. But with him, I try, because there's usually a very good and deep reason behind his such suggestions on his part. So I started to look at the whole picture of the Bach suite in a different way, and to figure out whether I might feel ready to make such a distinct document. It's recordings are something very different than a performance, because it's not fleeting. It's not over when it's over, right? And we need to treat it as its own serious art form. So I made very careful research and made an edition of my own with articulations and bowings that I liked, and created actually two sets, one for the repeats. And my students are using that now. They don't always find it comfortable, but in the end, they usually understand the logic behind it. But it took a lot of thinking and a lot of actually just at one point saying, it's got to happen. In all humility, Bach will never be anything but a giant to all of us. And no matter how long you study or perform this music, every day brings new insight into the architecture and the spirit behind this music. So one is never done. And in that sense, one, you just have to pick a point and say, it's something that's hopefully worth other people hearing, but it's not the end.
The thing that I've always understood about the cello suites, not being a cellist or violist myself, is that the manuscript, maybe even especially in this case compared to other Bach pieces, gives very, very little direction. So you sort of have to either accept somebody else's edition or, as you say, generate your own. When you say two editions, one for repeats, what does that mean exactly?
Well, what we have in the case of the cello suites is no manuscript. We have pieces of paper that were written by Anna Magdalena, but we have nothing in Bach's handwriting. So what we have is already a secondary source, and then we have a couple of fairly close corresponding texts, which we all use, the Kellner manuscript and so on. But in the end, if you look at all the source material and read Honor Bylsma's book about Bach and the suites, you get the idea that this has to be a very personal, direct conversation between you and Bach. Because he never laid it out for us. And whether or not we believe every pen stroke of Anna Magdalena is a big issue. So we are a little bit more on our own. And there are some nice, clean additions which are good to use as base material. In the end, however, one has to suit that material to what you feel about the dance forms, what you want to be conveying. And when I say two different versions, I mean a different set of bowings and articulations that bring out different aspects, perhaps rhythmically or in terms of long phrasing, trying to bring out different aspects in the repeats.
That's great. That's great. One thing I love about this recording is not only your own very beautiful, very poetic program note that's accompanying the recording, but also that written by Paul Griffiths. Mm-hmm. He brings up something that I've never actually heard, and maybe that's more my own ignorance, but he talks about the preludes sort of having, it's almost like, I hope this is an accurate summary of what he says, basically having sort of the source material for the rest of the movements in each suite, that when you play the prelude, you can hear what, it's almost like a preview of aspects. Is that how you think of them when you play them? And is it something you feel like listeners can really pick up distinctly in any or all of the preludes?
I think it's absolutely there. That thread, red thread through each suite is absolutely there. I don't know whether your average listener on first listening would hear that, but I think very often when you get to the final movement, the Gigue, you think back and you say, oh, yes, of course. Of course. It's all inside of one structure. Yeah. All these gems are inside of one structure.
That's great. One more question about it. You wanted to go with a very specific arrangement of the suites in an order on the recording, as opposed to what we would normally see on a recording of these suites, which is 1 through 6, straight ahead, two follows one, et cetera. But you have an order to them. And tell me what that means and why you wanted to arrange them that way.
The order on this recording is primarily driven by an emotional thread rather than the chronological thread or looking for some way to bring them all into synchronization key-wise, which is not actually possible. So we went for the emotional thread, and Manfred's distinct advice was start with the D minor. That's you. And I have to agree. I mean, I'm an Armenian person. I tend to have to work out of the black cloud every morning. And you work your way out of it, and then the day is normal. But, you know, starting with that kind of pensive, inward-looking music seemed appropriate to both of us.
Wow. Wow. I love that. That's just such a fantastic approach to these. It's really beautiful. And just on a really technical basis, there is that one suite. It's the sixth suite that involves the extra string. Was that a special piece of equipment you had to have made or modification to your instrument? Or how do you deal with that?
That's a good question, too. It is. I do play it on a 5-string viola, which is the equivalent of the 5-string instrument that Bach wrote this for. It's not exactly a viola pomposa. It's not big enough. Mine is not big enough to be considered that. It's a normal looking viola with an extra wide neck and fingerboard and the extra string. So I had the E string, which he meant to have, which meant that all the bariolage passages worked really beautifully, and I could play in the original key, which most violists don't, right? So that definitely was, that was part of the project from 25 years ago or longer. I had this instrument built for me by Bisolotti, and he lived in Cremona at the time. He's recently passed away. It's a beautiful viola. My original thought was that I wanted a low string, an extra low string, to be able to do the Bach Gamba sonatas without having to shift range. And the low string sounds very beautiful, but it's very hard to articulate. So that project actually never got off the ground that way. But when I did record with Keith Jarrett, I used a four-string viola.
Okay. Yeah.
And the five-string viola sat on a shelf for a long time, and then I thought, you know what? I could play Schubert Arpeggione without having to compress the range if I had an E string. And then, of course, the sixth suite for the same reason. So I started experimenting with it.
I was just going to ask whether this is the only piece that you use the five-string viola for, but no, Arpeggione, and maybe there are others as well. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it is a very useful... during the weeks that I was exclusively playing on it because of the confusion that ensues when you have a middle string suddenly, I taught on that instrument too. And I blithely went over to the E string for all the high passages in the Bartok concerto. And my students were going, well, of all the nerve.
That's fantastic. Kim Kashkashian, thanks so much for your time. Thank you for Music for Food. It's such an important project, and it's so good to be in the room when that happens, because you're right, the spirit in those concerts is really something special. So thank you for that, and thank you for Bach as well, and for your time today.
Thank you. It's been really fun to talk to you. Bye-bye.